Our next case is number 02-1916, Learning Curve Toys against Playwood Toys.
May it please the court, my name is John Lutchinger. I represent the appellant Playwood Toys. With me is Michael Docterman and Gabriella Felisco. Your Honors, we are here today about a concept which by Learning Curve's own testimonial was the greatest innovation in the particular industry in decades. It's a concept which translated into shelf space for Toy Track, which this company had desperately wanted but before could not receive. And it's a concept that has translated into tens and in excess of $100 million in sales for Track alone when before the company couldn't make sales of Track. The record is undisputed that Learning Curve, a rather new company, was under significant pressure from its Thomas the Tank Engine licensor. I want Track on the shelves in the stores. This is a very profitable product. Why are you not selling Track? The reason was all they had was the generic plain smooth Track, which its long-standing predecessor, Brio, had basically captured in the market. They had all the shelf space. What Learning Curve had was these great trains with the faces from the cartoon Thomas the Tank Engine. They were selling those. They're compatible with the Learning Curve, with the Brio Track, but they couldn't sell the Track, which again is a very profitable product. And the request from the licensor was very specific. We don't want bells. We don't want whistles. We don't want batteries. We want it to be simple. We want it to be different, but we want it to be simple. We want children to have to use their imagination, and we want them to have to push the cars, but we want the Track to be different. And they tried. The record is undisputed. Their own people testified, and they produced documents. This was a corporate endeavor. Differentiate this Track. And they studied the market, and they experimented, and they used their outside inventor, Mr. Wilson. And they experimented with stamping stuff on the Track, burning railroad impressions to make it look a little bit more like Track, putting clouds on the Track, trying to leverage the Thomas the Tank Engine branding, put that on the Track. They never experimented with anything near what became Clickety-Clack Track. It's undisputed that these folks came to Canada after having just met the Playwood folks at a toy fair in New York. They wanted to come up the next day. Mr. Clousey from Playwood said, wait a second, I want to learn your products. I want to study what you're doing before you come up. That's in the record. They did meet shortly after. I think it was about a week after. And they were discussing the possibility of entering into a business relationship, possibly having Playwood make some of their toys because they like their wood product displayed at Toy Fair. Before the meeting began, the evidence is somewhat disputed, but significant, that Mr. Abraham and Mr. Wilson said, before we start, our practice is, and we need to ask you, we want our conversations and our exchanges of materials to be confidential. That was their practice. They had had long-standing prior verbal agreements of that nature. Playwood, being the underdog, agreed, didn't demand a writing, and said, us too. We have information we'd like to disclose. We have ideas. We accept your proposal. Please accept ours. And there was a meeting of the minds. Did that happen? I wasn't there. I don't know. I think the fact that there's a question answers the question that we're here to discuss today. was there sufficient evidence for the jury to make that conclusion. The jury was specifically instructed, you must find that there was a confidential relationship if you're going to find in favor of Playwood. There's more than just the testimony, two against two. Learning Curve provided prototypes, drawings that they said related to products that had not been patented yet, spreadsheets with cost information, vendor information. They gave us a lot of information which we at least regarded as confidential. I don't think, after having met someone a week ago without an understanding, that exchange would have been made. And these were two small companies. It is reasonable, as the law says, under the circumstances, to expect confidentiality without a written agreement, and the law doesn't require it. After the meeting, the Playwood folks went directly to their manufacturing source and amended their confidentiality agreement. Yes, it was in writing. There's no dispute that our people knew how to engage in a written agreement, but they were the underdog here. They were not the underdog with their manufacturer, and they amended the agreement to memorialize what had been discussed, that everything with Learning Curve was confidential. And then the exchanges of information afterwards, Playwood continued to stamp things confidential, and they've never disclosed a single piece of information provided by Learning Curve. The concept, as the evidence demonstrated, was patentable. They received a patent. By law, it was novel if the jury believed us that this was our concept. By law, it was not known outside of Learning Curve or Playwood's business.
Mr. Lechinger, would you just remind me of when Playwood learned of the patent?
Your Honor, Playwood first learned of the product introduction in December of 1994, and the only knowledge Playwood had from that point on was a generic patent pending reference on the label. We, of course, were not privy to the application or any information as it was pending. I think the patentability is important, not dispositive, but important. It shows value. It shows it was capable of being patented.
Is that where this case should have been fought out, on that playing field?
On the patent issue, Your Honor?
Mm-hmm.
No, I don't think so. I think the district court thought so. There were several references and inquiries to us, why didn't you receive a patent? As this court has held, we don't have that obligation. These were not savvy people. They didn't have the money to invest in a patent, and they were acting in good faith and in confidentiality. Both experts for both sides testified, this is normally how it's done in the toy business. Inventors come with raw concepts, without patents, enter into agreements, and proceed. So I don't think this was a patent case.
What was the time spent in developing this cut or whatever caused the clickety-clack? How long did it take them to do that?
It took them very little time, Your Honor. We think we should be counting the several days beforehand that Mr. Clousey was analyzing the products. He was obviously able to answer the question very quickly, but I'm not going to stand here and tell you this was not an innovation.
Now, when they left with the prototype didn't work perfectly, correct?
Yeah, absolutely, it did not work perfectly. What it did demonstrate was going beyond what the normal person would think, which is just put a mild cut in the track to make it look more like track. It showed that you go deeper into what's called the rails so that it would actually make a noise and go bumpity-bump, clickety-clack as it goes over it.
So all that they really had to do was make it a little deeper.
They had to make it, the concept was go into the rails, make it deeper, make sure the train wheels are going to interact with the track and not just pass smoothly. What the problem was in Canada was if you took the track and you tilted it, the train probably wouldn't move. But certainly if you ran it across, it demonstrated the clickety-clack, and it demonstrated the idea and the concept of the grooves inside the rails.
What's the size of these? I don't think we had any indication in the briefs what size these trains are.
I regret that I didn't bring a piece of the track. The trains are basically about an inch and a half wide and a couple inches long, like this. And the track is about an inch wide and about a quarter of an inch, half an inch thick. It's the stuff we've been seeing.
Similar to the size of what we might think of electric trains.
Exactly. Exactly. And significantly, whether it be electric trains or the old racing cars, there's never been any track in any toy industry where you've had that phenomenon, where you've had the noise and the feel and the sensation without using batteries or electricity.
Does the record contain a comparison of the prototype and the finished product?
Well, the problem, Your Honor, is, and Learning Curve admitted, they asked for and they took the prototype mm-hmm. with them.
Yes, remember.
Gave it to their president. And
did that disappear along with the fax sheets and the diary entries and all the other things that disappeared?
The transfer.
The original.
Yes, Your Honor. The exchange of information was very detailed at the trial. Mr. Wilson and Abraham asked for and took it, put it in their briefcase, had a meeting with the president from Learning Curve. He took the track and put it in his trunk. They had a discussion about it. We, of course, asked for it. And it's not only is it missing, but now they're suggesting that it's our fault, that we don't have it here to compare. I see that I'm into my rebuttal. I'm happy to continue or defer.
Thank you, Mr. Lechner.
Thank you.
We'll hear now from Mr. Price.
Thank you very much. Roger Price, together with Dick Reinisch, on behalf of Learning Curve Toys and related individuals. And Judge Caney, to answer your question really directly and give the court perhaps a sample of what we're talking about, this is the track. Defendant's Exhibit 10 was the Brio-type track. And this is Thomas, the train. And it runs in rail channels. So console is right about an inch and a half in width. Console began his argument today.
Could we have it up here? I'd like to.
You know, I knew if I did this, then everybody would want one.
And we thought, we wondered whether all the toys made it from the district court to the appellate court. Apparently not.
Counsel began his argument today, as indeed they spent most of the time at trial, talking about Learning Curve's toy and Learning Curve's track and Learning Curve's practice, but not about Playwood's trade secret. Counsel then talked about confidentiality at the Toronto meeting, but counsel didn't refer to the record, because the record indicates that Mr. Clousey, the principal of Playwood, talked about confidential manufacturing processes long before he came up with the invention that they claim is the trade secret. Counsel says that the agreement of the parties was reflected in this manufacturing agreement that was prepared. Playwood prepared it. You can look at that agreement. I can't remember if it's DX23 or PX23, but it's somewhere around there. You can look at that agreement all day long, and you won't see any confidentiality agreement running towards Playwood. It was all Learning Curve. It says nothing about Playwood's alleged trade secret. And again, they talk about Playwood's patent, but not Learning Curve's trade secret. And Judge Rovner, you were correct. This battle should have been fought there had they really believed that we improperly were designated as the inventor of that invention. They should have complained to the patent office, but they didn't. Playwood's had a conceptual problem, and I don't mean to use that in the form of a pun, from the beginning of this case. Beginning with the opening brief, Playwood said the trade secret, or the question about the trade secret, was whether there was a realistic looking and sounding track. That wasn't accurate. Playwood never produced a realistic looking and sounding track. The record is clear. Two perpendicular cuts to the plane were made in the rail channels. The first didn't go through far enough. The second one went too far. The first generated no noise. The second one was a gouge, and the train couldn't go through. By the time we got to the reply brief...
Then why did you want to take it with you?
The original concept, the original purpose of the meeting was to determine whether Playwood had manufacturing capability. And the only evidence of manufacturing capability were the two cuts that Mario Borsato cut into that one piece of track which we supplied. The more important question, which we'll talk about later, is why, if this was a valuable trade secret, Playwood gave it to Learning Curve, kept no record of it, asked for no receipt back. Let's return to the question of whether Playwood had this trade secret, because by the time we get to the reply brief, they're not talking about realistic track, they're talking about a design concept. Let's look at the record as to what happened in this case. In October of 1993, 6 months, 7 months or longer after this meeting in Toronto, Playwood produced a record of its achievements in 1993. It did not list any trade secret in DX53. And in 1994, in November, when it complained to Learning Curve about Learning Curve's track, it didn't complain about a misappropriation of a trade secret. It complained that Learning Curve was stealing a marketing idea. What is it that we tried to do in the trial court, or what did Judge Pallmeyer do?
Would they win this case if they had brought it as stealing a marketing idea?
No, because it wouldn't have, that wouldn't have risen to a level that would have been susceptible of damages either. What Judge Pallmeyer did, pursuant to our motion under Rule 50, was to engage in a classic six-factor analysis to determine whether a trade secret exists. And for purposes of this brief argument and consistent with the Trade Secret Act, I'd like to focus on two: economic value and efforts to maintain secrecy. What was it Playwood developed that had value, and what was the nature of that value? The record contains...
$40 million.
Judge, the Trade Secret Act talks about actual value, it talks about potential value, but it doesn't talk about vicarious value. What their witness testified to was vicarious value. But let me get to it. I'll get to that in just a second, because what their principal said at trial was that the track that was cut by Mario Borsato in Toronto had no play value. And I think we can agree that a toy that doesn't have play value doesn't have a whole lot of value. It wasn't realistic looking, and it made no noise. Now, rather than talk about the value of the trade secret, they brought in Mr. Michael Kennedy, a former general counsel at Tyco Toys. What did Mr. Kennedy say? Mr. Kennedy said that Learning Curve's track, with its character license, Thomas the Tank, with its patent, with its trademark, and as Mr. Kennedy said, nicely packaged, and I think that's true, that toy had tremendous value. But he was not asked about design concepts, and he was not asked about trade secrets. His report, Plaintiff's Exhibit 182, does not mention Playwood, and it does not mention a trade secret. And when he was asked, and we asked him, when he was asked what would happen if you took away from Learning Curve's track the patent and the character license and the trademark, he said, all you would have is a generic piece of wood, just like DX10, just like Brio's wood. And plaintiff's dilemma really is that it's trying to get a trade secret in a product that's destined, theoretically at least, for the retail market. And as long as that product is kept in a cabinet, it really has, and no one knows about it, no one cares about it, it really has no value. As Mr. Kennedy agreed, in order to have value, the product must be sold. But if it were sold, it would lose its value, because that product, as simple as it is, no bells, no whistles, no moving parts, no chips, no computer programs, a simple piece of wood could easily be reproduced by anybody. Mr. Clousey testified when he was asked specifically, the product that he produced, the cut piece of track, provided no competitive advantage. And if there's no competitive advantage, then there's no value. That's the lesson under the Syntex case, and that is the lesson of the Trade Secrets Act. But moreover, Playwood took no effort, made no effort, to protect its purported secret. This court knows better than I do about a lot of efforts that various parties take to protect secrets. Sometimes these secrets are stored in a special room. Sometimes there's a vault. Sometimes the secret's dispersed among various people. Sometimes there's written confidentiality agreements. Sometimes the information is coded. This court had a case a couple of weeks ago, that was decided a couple of weeks ago, I think, where there was a motion detector in the room that had the vault with the secret code. Now, we're not suggesting that Playwood had to have a vault or motion detector, but Playwood had to do something. Playwood had to do something to protect its alleged secret. But Playwood did nothing. It was familiar with written confidentiality agreements. It had them with Mr. Borsato before they even met Learning Curve. Never asked Learning Curve to sign a written confidentiality agreement. Playwood kept no copy of this allegedly valuable trade secret, made no picture of it, never measured the depths of the cuts that were made, didn't keep a drawing of it. Not only didn't put the track in a cabinet, as we said before, and as Mr. Lutchinger said, they gave it to us. Didn't even ask for a receipt. Never sent a letter saying, oops, that was valuable, give it back to me. And when, again, Learning Curve got its patent, never contested it.
Is it possible that in good faith they honestly believed these, you know, three fellows, two fellows and the woodcutter up there in Canada, that they were, you know, as I say, dealing in good faith? Is that possible?
If they believed in good faith, what?
They could hand it to you. They thought you all were negotiating.
We were negotiating at the time about a manufacturing process, manufacturing facilities to manufacture product for us. We weren't negotiating about them coming up with new ideas. And whether they thought, whether they were naive or they were in good faith, I really couldn't say, and the record doesn't suggest it. What I do know is that the Jackson and Hammer case and the Southwest Way case and every other case that I've seen in reviewing my materials for today require a claimant of a trade secret to take affirmative measures.
Bryce, let me ask you, in the in this meeting in Toronto, was a piece of track involved the size, or do we know?
I'm sorry?
Was a piece of track involved the size that you've given?
I believe the track, I don't remember if it was a 4-inch track or a 6-inch track.
But it was that.
Yeah.
No more than six in any case.
I don't believe it was more than six.
And
it was a piece of straight track, one curved track or anything.
And the discussion, why was the track presented at that time?
There was a, if you take the Playwood version of it, there was a discussion about differentiating track. And I don't know whether that happened any more than Mr. Lechinger knows whether that happened. But taking it as true, Roy Wilson said, here's a piece of track, what can you do with it? And there were some cuts made in it.
Differentiating from competitors' tracks?
Differentiating it from the plain vanilla track you have in front of you or someone has in front of him. Yes. The cases require affirmative steps to protect a secret. And as Judge Posner said in the Rockwell case, the more the trade secret owner spends to prevent leaks, the more he demonstrates the track has value. There was no expenditure here, and there's no value here. Playwood did nothing. In conclusion, I must say that Playwood's case here is truly unprecedented. Truly unprecedented. I don't know of a case, and Playwood hasn't cited any, where the evidence for the trade secret is as weak as it is here. Playwood has cited no case, not one, where the investment of time and money is as limited as it is here, and a court still found there was a trade secret. Playwood has cited
the nuts over the cookies?
I don't recall the nuts over the cookie case, but my sense is that's not a case that was in that came out of Illinois law, because I know under the Webb case there was virtually no time and effort put in, and the court threw out the trade secret. But there is no case under the Illinois Trade Secrets Act, certainly, where the investment of time was as limited as here.
Peggy Lawton Kitchens, I think, it's a Massachusetts case. I think that's right. I'm almost certain.
I can't speak to.
I
can't speak to a case in Massachusetts. All I can look at is the cases under the Illinois Trade Secrets Act, and there's no case that plaintiff has cited where the secret was as simple as this. And again, not a program, not movable parts, not a recipe or anything. It's a little piece of wood.
Oh, there are a lot of simple cases.
And so easily capable of being duplicated, of such limited value, where the court found there was a trade secret. And there was no case, and Playwood has cited no such case, where there's been such a lack of protection, where the claimant literally gave the alleged secret away, and a court still found that there was a trade secret. And obviously no case where all of these factors are combined into one gigantic, colossal case of weakness, and the court found that there was a trade secret. Now, Playwood can't change the record. It can't offer any more. It can complain about learning curve all day long, but it can't do here what it didn't do in the trial court, and that is prove its case, which it had a burden to do, and show that it had a trade secret. The trial court looked closely at the record, the undisputed concessions of Playwood's personnel and its expert as to value and efforts to maintain secrecy, and she found nothing there, much less the substantial evidence necessary to defeat Learning Curve's motion. The record is clear, and her analysis is sound.
Mr. Price, your time has expired.
Thank you. We ask that you affirm.
Mr. Lettinger, you have 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Judge Rovner, it was a Massachusetts case, Peggy Lawton, but it was also a Uniform Trade Secret Act case. So it is applicable. And we also have Lemonade, another trade secret case, Uniform Trade Secret case. I think what I heard Mr. Price say was we don't know whether a piece of track was supplied by Learning Curve to Playwood. That I didn't say. That track was that's in the record. The track was given, and your question for what purpose? I haven't heard another purpose. They saw our manufacturing capabilities in New York when they went to Toy Fair. That's why they asked to meet with us. They saw our wood trains. They needed a wood supplier. I'd like to go to the six factors, Your Honor. It seems that we, as I suspected, are talking about secrecy. They have to, because the district court made it paramount. Mr. Price correctly said there has to be some affirmative act. The jury was charged very sternly on that. It was an absolute requirement. Judge Pallmeyer made her own decision. She actually went through an analysis in the opinion and weighed the evidence. I'm going to discount this. I'm going to charge you because you didn't ask for a written agreement. And she made a finding against us on a fact that was adequately supported by sufficient evidence. And the jury had to have found that to make their ruling. They were told you must find a confidential relationship. From that ruling and finding improperly on secrecy, which was a finding of fact, it tainted the value analysis. The district court said there's no value here because you didn't have it secret. It tainted and caused an enormous focus on this reverse engineering issue. Mr. Price is wrong. You can have a benefit from something because you're allowed to take it out of the closet, even if it's simple, as long as it's cloaked with confidentiality. That's at the heart of the Trade Secret Act.
What's the only difference between the original track that disappeared and the one that's sitting on the bench? What's the only difference?
Your Honor, does that one have the clickety-clack?
No, it has no grooves in it.
Well,
you want to examine it?
No, that's okay. I didn't think it was the clickety-clack track. The clickety-clack track versus the prototype is basically more refined. It's smoother. And the grooves are not so deep that the train gets stuck. In fairness, that's what the testimony was at trial.
Because it doesn't really clickety-clack.
That's not the track at issue.
Oh, okay.
That's the Brio. That's the old track that they needed to distinguish against.
Oh, okay.
You can take it out of the closet. You can cloak it with confidentiality. That's how we heard both experts say that's how most inventors come to these toy companies with their inventions. Mr. Price did what the court did. He started weighing the confidentiality issue and the secrecy issue here before you today. I listed five major pieces of evidence that were before the jury. And the jury was expressly charged, you must find a confidential relationship. And they had to make their ruling. Mr. Price also just imposed what the district court did. When you look at the value analysis that the court went through, imposed a use requirement. He said you have to use it before you can have value. That's not true. And the Trade Secret Act code or sections comments specifically say it. The use requirement has been abolished. We don't have it anymore. The Rockwell case, those drawings were sent out to customer after customer after customer. That's why Judge Williams initially gave summary judgment. The court brought it back and said, there's evidence here. There's a question of fact as to whether there were appropriate steps taken. Submit, Your Honors, that what happened here was a substitution of judgment on making a ruling on fact, and I respectfully request that the court reverse the lower court.
Thanks to both Mr. Lessinger and Mr. Price for their fine presentations. Mr. Clerk, I'll hand you the train to give back to counsel. The case is taken under